Good afternoon, everybody. I would like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services to order. And do I have to open a work session on any of these or just?
No, you can just.
Okay, we're going to, we don't have the paperwork yet on Senate Bill 382, so that will be carried over till next.
To Tuesday.
To next Tuesday. And then we will carry over Senate Bill 823. We will move that also to Tuesday. And I will open a work session on House Bill 2896. Or do we need more people to do this?
No, that's right.
Okay.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which the Dash 6 amendments dated March 26, 2013 were adopted.
Okay, Senator Steinmeier Hayward moves to reconsider the vote by which the committee adopted the Dash 6 amendments dated 3-26-13. And colleagues, you will remember that Senator Shields was concerned that there wasn't parental consent, that we lost parental consent. So what we want, should I just give this to him then?
Yeah.
So we're now reconsidering the vote of the Dash 6s because we're concerned about the.
Senator Steiner Hayward put the motion on the table.
Yeah. So is there any discussion on removing the Dash 6s? Is there any objection? If not, the motion carries and the measure is once again before the committee in its original form.
Okay, you want these?
And.
Oh, no, that's wrong.
No, we want.
Dash 7s now, don't we?
Dash 8s.
Sorry.
And before us is the Dash 8s, which is really interesting because it starts out with it bans tanning for 18 and under, and then it qualifies that between 17 and 18 that you need parental consent, and then under 17 you would need a physician's order. So that's how that Dash 8 is, and I think it would address everybody's concerns. Okay?
So, Madam Chair, if
yes.
I can, so it's your understanding that this is a compromise that everybody is dissatisfied with, but basically gets to the compromise of the 17 being the major number.
The OHSU is still opposed. They wanted a ban at 18. All right. Total.
And they wanted a doctor's note at 18.
Yeah.
Forgive me for clarifying.
Yes, a doctor's note. Yes. Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 8 amendment dated 4-10-13 to House Bill 2897.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves to adopt the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2896. Is there any discussion?
I'm just going to put on the record that I still have significant concerns about this, and I think that the original bill was better, but I'll accept this as a compromise that at least gets us much further toward protecting children from something they really don't need.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right.
And Dash 8.
Pardon?
No.
Okay, so have you moved this
I've
already?
Moved,
okay.
Moved it.
Is there any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Oh, hold on.
Oh, yes.
On the bill?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, we've just moved the amendment. Or have we moved the bill?
Just the amendment.
Is this a vote on the amendment?
This is a vote on the amendment.
Okay.
Okay, is there any opposition? Adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2896 as amended by the Dash 8 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2896 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no on the bill and a no in committee, and for a couple of reasons. And one is that there's already parental consent involved, and the second is it's a well-regulated exercise that people have to go through, and furthermore, I think all we're doing is pushing kids into an unregulated area because I don't think they're going to stop tanning, and so unless this body is willing to ban independent tanning beds or the sale of tanning beds in the state, I think all we're doing is, quite frankly, endangering kids in a different way, because there's no regulation. And so, you know, I can see where these very inexpensive tanning beds could be used in homes, no regulation whatsoever. And ultimately, I don't think this solves the problem that people are looking to solve.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sandra Hewitt.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
No.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Jameson.
Aye. Motion carries. And Carrier is Senator Johnson, I believe. Yes.
Madam Chair, I need to step up.
Yes. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2896. Okay, and is Representative Springer here? Yes. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 457. Representative Springer.
Did you come up with her?
And Daryl Fuller and Jason Myers.
Yeah,
might as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. What I briefly want to chat with you about is an amendment to Senate Bill 457. It would be the Dash 1 amendment. This issue came to me, and I actually had some understanding of it. Years ago, in my prior life, I was a deputy sheriff and worked the road and patrolled and arrested people and took people to jail and helped little kids find their bikes and took incarcerated inmates, because I was a deputy and worked for a county, incarcerated inmates to the hospital or the doctor's office once in a while. No, that was not my favorite duty, but it was something I was assigned to do occasionally. And when we would do that, all of us had to do it at one time or another. It always struck me because that was typically the first time a particular person, the inmate, had received health care. Oftentimes it was the first time since the last time they were in jail, because the toothache became a really big problem, or whatever became a really big problem and needed to be dealt with. And who pays that bill? The jail does. The county does. Where does the county get the money? From the taxpayers. And I admit to you my frustration when people would not go to the doctor because they didn't have health care sometimes, or because of whatever reason, these issues would mount up, and then the county would be paying for the health care costs that were incurred. So what I bring before you now, and these two gentlemen are going to do the heavy lifting and tell you what the bill really does, but basically it is a way to help counties with some of those costs. We ask for more and more and more from our cities and from our counties, and there's less and less to do it. Now, this isn't a city issue, hardly. I think there just might be a couple in the state that incarcerate. It's a county issue. And in my counties, Lynn and Marion counties, it's up to the sheriff to deal with this. So this bill will gives a couple pieces of relief. One is if a person is insured when they come in, the insurance company can't drop them just because they're now incarcerated. Is that helpful? I think that's marginally helpful. I admit the majority of times when I arrested people and went through their personal belongings and stowed them away for safekeeping, rarely was there an insurance card there. Occasionally there was. But let's capture those that do. The other thing is the reimbursement rates to be at the Medicare rate. I know that many of our sheriffs negotiate rates with local providers. They need more help. They need more help. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to these two gentlemen. I'll certainly answer any questions if you may have them. I need to get to another meeting at the pleasure of the good chair here. But I'll certainly answer questions if you have them.
Any questions? We probably will have some after the panel.
They've got particular numbers.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. joined by Marion County Sheriff Jason Myers, who's president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I'll provide a brief overview of the bill and then turn it over to Sheriff Myers, who will talk a little bit about some of the specifics within Marion County. As Representative Springer indicated, when somebody is arrested, and whether they're arrested by a city police officer, a state police officer, or a county deputy, they all go to the county jails when they get incarcerated prior to trial, and sometimes they stay there after they've been adjudicated. And when they are in the county jail, all of their health care benefits disappear. They no longer have veterans benefits, and there's nothing you can do about that. They no longer get Medicare, and there's nothing you can do about that. The Oregon Health Plan disappears. I would think there's something you could do about that, but I'm told that part of the waiver we get from the federal government says we can't cover them when they're in jail. So you can't even change at the state level the Oregon Health Plan covering people when they're incarcerated. But some inmates, not a lot, but some inmates do have private health care when they come to the jail. But private health care carriers also deny coverage and in some cases cancel people because they're in jail. And this bill will correct that, what we believe to be error, because the premiums are being paid, and we believe that if somebody is incarcerated and they are insured on a policy, that the health insurer should not be able to deny coverage simply because they happen to be in jail. Further, we do not believe that an insurance company ought to be able to cancel somebody simply because they are in jail. Now, I want to make this real clear because I had a conversation, and so did the chair with Betsy Earls with Associated Oregon Industries. It is not our intent, and we don't believe the amendments do this, it is not our intent that an employer would have to continue to cover somebody under their health care plan even though they've been fired because they're in jail. If somebody goes to jail, and because they don't show up for work, they get fired, they lose their health care benefits. And the provision in the amendments that you have before you that says they can't cancel just because they're in jail, we don't intend to mean, and we're happy to make adjustments in the wording if necessary, that somehow that is a permanent health care plan for somebody who's in jail and the employer has to continue to cover them even though they're no longer employed. So I want to be very, very clear that that is not our intent, and if there needs to be a language remedy in that case, that we're happy to support changes in the statute. The final thing that the bill does is that it adjusts the rates that medical service providers charge the jail from retail to the Medicare rate. Right now, sheriffs across the state of Oregon in some cases have good relationships with medical service providers and they can negotiate reasonably good rates. But in a lot of cases, they're paying an awful lot more than we think they ought to. And we believe restricting the providers to the Medicare rate will save an enormous amount of money. In fact, that part of the bill probably will save the most money for sheriff offices around the state. Along with the testimony that I submitted that you should have on OLIS are two or three pages of stories from different sheriffs from around the state that I do hope you get a chance to read that talks about some of the costs that sheriffs are incurring around the state on a regular basis. You also have on OLIS a spreadsheet that was provided by the Washington County Sheriff's Office on some of the health care costs they've experienced over the last two fiscal years that runs them into the millions of dollars that they're paying for health care for inmates who are in their custody. As you know, sheriff's offices around the states are in dire straits financially, especially those in the ONC counties. These are bills that we can't just not pay because we have an obligation to take care of the health care of the inmates that are in our custody. So in some cases, we literally are making the choice of taking somebody to the hospital, which we have to do, or paying for bullets and paying for deputies and paying for search and rescue equipment and the other things that we simply have to do as our obligations as sheriffs. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Sheriff Myers. We'll talk a little bit about what's happening in Marion County, and then we're happy to answer any questions you have.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff, and I'm also the president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and Representative Springer and Darrell Fuller have done a great job of explaining the situation that we're facing. I just want to give you an example in our local county here of some of the skyrocketing costs that we've been paying for medical services, in particular hospital services, for offenders that are in our custody that have to be admitted into the hospital because of a medical condition. In just this last fiscal year, comparing from 2011 to 2012, our hospital services have increased by 156%. In terms of dollars, in 2011, we spent $181,000 on hospital services for offenders. In 2012, in this fiscal year, we're going to spend $465,000. As you know, counties are in distress. Our county is no different than, well, we're probably in better shape than some of the southern Oregon counties, but our revenues are increasing at less than 1%, and 156% increase in this one line item for our budget means we're going to have to cost shift, and it's going to be programs, it's going to be people, it'll be deputy sheriffs, more than likely, or jail beds. If this rate continues to increase that way. So any help we can get with this, we'd appreciate. It will spread our services further and into the community to be able to keep our community safe. So thank you for listening today.
Madam Chair, could I just draw your attention to on page 2 of my testimony at the bottom? This comes out of the Linn County Sheriff's Office. There's one part that I highlighted, and with your indulgence, I'll read it. This is on a case that happened in March of 2010. There was a hospital bill of $51,312, and at the time, the inmate had health care, and it was paid for by the insurance company. After discovering that he was in custody during his hospital stay, the hospital had to reimburse insurance, and we were billed for the full amount. So there was a case that we have on record where the insurance company paid the claim until they found out the person was in jail, and then sought reimbursement to not cover the person while they were in jail. And that's exactly the kind of incident that we're trying to avoid with the amendments to Senate Bill 457. Thank you.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Do you have a breakout of how many did have insurance, how many had no insurance, how many were Medicaid, or any breakout like that?
We haven't done that. We could probably do the breakout, but just my guess, a lot of these individuals do not have health care.
Right. Madam Chair, mm-hmm. I would suppose that a lot of your clients are either uninsured or are on Oregon Health Plan, I would assume.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's correct. We do have significant populations that are veterans that don't get veterans benefits that would have them otherwise. And, of course, that's something that this bill can't solve. But in cases where you're doing dialysis for somebody to the tune of thousands of dollars a month, if you have only one of those with health care coverage, the savings just on one or two cases in a county jail can be significant.
Well, my response would be, if I could, I have heard from some states that have been able to, for inpatient services for their Medicaid clients, been able to bill Medicaid for those services. And that's something I think OHA is working on right now, and which could be probably maybe a bigger savings than anything we could do if we could connect those dots. So,
yeah. Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does... For people who have insurance who end up in jail that have PEB and OWEB, are you guys able to bill and do they pay, or is that different?
Madam Chair, Senator Knope, as far as we know, all health care insurance stops at the jailhouse doors. Most of my county jailers are not in the process of collecting that data and trying to get them to pay simply because their experience is everybody says no. So there may be circumstances, there may even be insurance companies out there that are willing to pay claims, but the sheriff's offices, by and large, don't put the time and effort in simply because their experience is that they're always turned down, and even in cases where insurance has paid for it, they ask for the money back, and that's why we're looking for the statutory clarification would put sheriff's office in the position of saying we're going to take the time to find out when people are processed in whether or not they do have insurance available to them so that we can take advantage of it, not have to waste a lot of time on filing claims that are going to be denied.
So follow up, is the bill intended to then get all insurance or just the commercial carriers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Knope, it would be all private insurance. We would consider health insurance provided by the state of Oregon to still be a private health insurer. It's not a Medicare or Medicare. It would be insurance that's provided by an employer or that's purchased on the exchange or other marketplaces.
Mm-hmm. Senator Steiner-Hagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, could we ask Ms. Thompson, are you willing, would it be okay if we asked her? Because I have a question about the Medicaid piece of this. Would that be all right, Madam Chair? Thank you. Ms. Thompson, would you mind? Fuller, if you don't mind. When Mr. Fuller and I talked about this bill the other day, it was the first I'd ever heard that when someone is incarcerated, even just after being arrested, not after actually being adjudicated, that all of their government-paid health benefits go away, regardless of the source. So, and you're saying that OHA is looking into whether we can keep people on Medicaid? I mean, I'm looking at some of the examples in here, which include women who are pregnant. I mean, I thought by law, basically, every pregnant woman was OHP eligible, regardless of her incarceration status, but that's not true, huh?
That I'd have to get back to you on. Sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Thompson, Oregon Health Authority. That I'd have to get back to you on, but we are working on a bill right now that would address the inpatient care for inmates, and we're working with DOC and with OIA to get that drafted. It's actually up for a public hearing tomorrow on the House side.
Great. Okay. Follow up if I may,
yes.
Madam? And, I mean, I think this is honestly going to be more of a statement than a question, and it's going to be something I'm going to talk to some of our federal delegation about. I would guess, and I could be way wrong, that a lot of the veterans who end up in custody do so because of what are essentially service-related problems, addictions, PTSD that leads to crimes. You're nodding your head, Sheriff, so I'm going to assume that you agree with me.
Yes.
And the idea that our federal government would yank benefits from people who are essentially suffering from the results of their service to our country and then turn around and yank their benefits just because one of the adverse effects, if you will, of their illness is that they commit a crime, ticks me off, to be polite.
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, one of the other things that's really not highlighted in the information that we provided is the significant cost of medication for inmates that we pay as well. And in most cases, that's for mental illnesses. As you guys know, sadly, Oregon sheriffs are the mental health system in the state of Oregon right now because there isn't an infrastructure in place, and we play the role of the mental health provider for people that are incarcerated on a daily basis. And some of those medications that they are required to have to maintain stability are incredibly expensive. And again, we're paying full freight on those medications for the customers as they come in the door.
Okay, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Daryl. You said the instance that you were talking about was in Linn County where they provided the services and then were informed by the insurance company.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, yes, from the Linn County Sheriff's Office.
And I assume that the county sheriff felt that was unfair or unreasonable.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, all of the sheriffs believe that if somebody has insurance available to them, that they ought to be provided for as long as the premium continues to be paid.
Madam Chair, if I could you check this with your other members to see if anyone in the sheriff's offices around the state have filed complaints with the insurance division to see if they could get some relief? And looking at the policies or contracts, I'd be interested to see how that has proceeded, if any have. Have you heard of any that have?
Senator Shields, no, I have not, but we can certainly check and get back to you.
Great, thank you. Because you might want to pursue that, and I'd be interested to see how that goes.
Okay, any further discussion? It would be nice, since no one else has signed up for the bill, that we get, because I've heard negatives from the insurers, and I've heard positives from Multnomah County in particular. And so it would be nice to have a quick work group with the insurers, and I'm not sure who at the insurers. I see a number of you out there. Sandy, can we coordinate, get the names and...
Sure.
And let's have a quick work group with everybody in the room to see if there are problems. If not, we're going to pass this out, because if I don't hear any complaints, it would be good to have numbers, though, of how many do actually have insurance. Because I think we talked about earlier that if you are incarcerated and that your employer then, you know, fires you, then that person would not be eligible for insurance. It's those whose their spouse or their family are carrying insurance for that particular person. So I think the numbers would be very low, but to a small jail, it would be significant. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you for, and I'm looking forward to that bill. That's, I brought the issue up months ago, and I think this could be significant savings for both the county jails and DOC. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and it kind of dovetails with the bill that I think Senator Winters just dropped about a task force to look at health care and DOC.
Right.
So.
843,
we have scheduled. Lovely. Good. It's a good bill, too.
I mean, the reality of it is for inpatient services, I don't think we can cover things that go on in the jail with Medicaid, but there's got to be a good pathway to do inpatient.
I don't know why we couldn't.
The feds are fussy
okay.
about
well,
that.
Well, I mean, that's a separate issue. We'll deal with that later, but we don't take up
fussy. Fussy is a good word.
Yes.
Fussy.
Thank you very much,
Thank
panel.
You.
Very good issue. Mary Botkin, would you come forward?
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am sorry I got here late. Mary Botkin, for the record, with Oregon AFSCME. We represent the folks who work in Oregon's prisons. And we have struggled for years to determine a way to sort of get a handle on health care costs inside our prison system. The department, we've worked with the department, and the department has done an admirable job on trying to control the cost of prescription drugs by bulk purchasing and some other sort of innovative ways of managing those costs. However, health care continues to be one of the issues that is it just seems to be out of control in the department. And our union sort of looked at the idea this session of introducing a bill that would establish that OHP care would be the standard of care when the department looks at their legal responsibilities for standard of care for inmates. And we were sort of advised not to go there, but to look at it a little further. I think the sheriffs have done an admirable job here of getting this bill out in front of the committee, and I really want to thank the committee for taking this so seriously, because there is few things that rise as quickly in the way of costs inside the institutions as health care and the need for it. And so if we can start getting a handle on the rising health care costs, not by eliminating health care, but by just simply controlling the costs and establishing a better ceiling on those costs, I think it would be very helpful. And we would be very happy to work with the committee and the sheriffs in assisting in getting something passed.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And for those, I don't know if we said, but it's the Dash 1 amendments that we are, and it's a total gut and stuff. Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 457, and we will move or carry this over till Tuesday. So now we are... Okay, I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 123. Misty.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 123, to remind you, requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules establishing Oregon Foster Children's Bill of Rights. The Dash 2 amendments that you're considering today clarify that foster youth are guaranteed rights under the U.S. and Oregon constitutions, federal and state law, and administrative and case law, in addition to those in the Act. The Dash 2 amendments clarify that DHS would share age-appropriate information on rights with youth, and that the department would provide the information within 60 days of placement and make sure the youth still has access upon placement changes. The Dash 2 amendment specifies that youth in substitute care on or after the effective date of the act would be covered under this bill. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued for the Dash 2 amendment.
And what does the fiscal statement say?
For the biennium 2015 through 17, the total funds would be $224,586, with the equivalent of one FTE.
So this is a Ways and Means bill?
Yes.
Wait, can I ask the, I mean, if I may, Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
What in this, I mean, is it because the department would have to prepare materials? Is it because they'd have to train their staff? Is it, I mean, I haven't reread the bill recently, and so I may be missing something, but I don't understand. All this is doing is requiring caseworkers who are already interacting with children to give them information.
Let's call Mark, is it Mark McKechnie and
Stacy? I'm not trying to be difficult, Mr. McKechnie. I'm just trying to understand what's going on.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Kevin George.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I apologize.
At the Department of Human Services, I am the Child Wellbeing Program Manager. Mark McKechnie happens to be with Youth Rights and Justice, and he testified on the bill last week.
Okay.
Sorry. We apologize.
Chairman Sanderson and others, the bill really does ask for many of the same practices that you are alluding to, the caseworkers are meeting with young people and children. And the cost on the fiscal is about the FTE. So the bill asks for that we create an ombudsman's office to actually answer complaint calls if kids are going to be able to call into the office, which is where Ms. Steenson would be talking about from the governor's advocacy office. So that's where the big fiscal piece is. The rest of it is around developing publications that would be provided. The bill asks for a bill of rights that the youth are provided to when they come into care on annually reviewed, that there are posters created that would be in all the foster homes and all the residential programs. So that's where the costs are added to that.
All right. Thank you. Sorry for the confusion.
Okay.
All right, and there were no amendments.
It's a dash two.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 123.
Senator Cruz moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 123. Is there any discussion?
Madam
Is there
Chair.
Any opposite? Oh, yes.
I understand that, you know, the need for the FTE. I think one of the things that hopefully Ways and Means will also consider is that this could end up saving a whole lot in DOJ costs and lawsuit settlement costs by keeping kids from being engaged in major lawsuit settlements against the state. So I know that that's more difficult to describe, but I think this legislation will more than pay for itself, and I hope Ways and Means will keep that in mind when we send this on down there.
I'll be there. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any opposition to the dash...
Two
amendments. Amendment adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 123 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments, the floor with the due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral of the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 123 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion?
Actually, there was no prior reference. We're just sending it there.
Could you please come forward so we can understand what you're telling us?
No.
There was no prior reference.
We added it. So,
added the referral.
So,
okay.
So just remove your prior reference.
Okay, I am removing the prior reference,
okay.
And it is just being sent to Ways and Means.
Right.
Okay. Now, clerk, we'll call the roll.
Senator Heron.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Motion carries, and that is on its way to Ways and Means. I now would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 136.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 136, you'll recall, has to do with the authorizing the certified registered nurse anesthetist to write prescriptions. You have before you,
okay.
Well, we have a couple amendments, Madam Chair. Which one would you like to begin
okay,
talking about?
Okay, we have two amendments, the dash fives and the dash sixes. So I would like, who is here to talk about the dash fives? Fawn.
And then, is Mr. Cosgrove coming up? No? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Fawn Berry, representing the Oregon Association of Nurse Anesthetists. We're here today to ask for your support of the Dash 5 amendments and Senate Bill 136. You've heard in public testimony the reasons why we're supporting this legislation. We've given you copies of the study that was done in Washington State on CRNA prescriptive authority there. It talks about the fact that only 30% of CRNAs have actually used this prescriptive prescriptive authority there, and there have been no complaints about the prescriptions that they have been prescribing or issues that have been brought up to their Board of Nursing there. But I want to focus on the Dash 5 amendments and the changes that they make to the bill. They do several things. They remove the dispensing authority for CRNAs, which is to address concerns that we heard. They address concerns from the Board of Nursing about education requirements and emergency suspensions. They add in language that specifies that CRNAs will only be able to prescribe to patients for whom the CRNA has an established client or patient record. And they limit CRNA prescriptive authority to 30-day prescription with no refill. For the record, I also want to make sure that the committee knows that in rules for the nurse practitioners and the CNSs, there is language that states prescribing is limited by the individual's scope of practice and knowledge base within the scope of practice. We'd anticipate that this would be rule language for Senate Bill 136 if it were to go into effect. I have with me Todd Meyer, who is a CRNA, who can answer any questions that the committee might have about specifics around prescribing or length of time or that kind of thing, but we would urge you to move forward with the Dash 5 amendments. We did compromise to get to the 30 days, and so we would really ask that the committee support the Dash 5s.
I have a question, because this is a question that I've been asked. When does an anesthesiologist or a nurse anesthetist prescribe? Because I've talked to an anesthesiologist, and he says in his entire career he has never prescribed. So can you let us know in what setting would you need this bill?
Sure, Madam Chair. Excuse me. It would be utilized in office-based procedures where if we had...
Oh, say your name.
I'm sorry. My name is Todd Meyer. I'm a nurse anesthetist, certified registered nurse anesthetist. In an office-based facility where we would be contacting patients prior to their procedures if they needed any preoperative medications, such as an anxiolytic or any anti-nausea medication, that would give us an opportunity to do that at that time during the preoperative interview.
And when would you ever need to have a 30-day timeline?
Madam Chair, Fawn Berry for the record. I think that the reason that we went with the 30 days, that was the suggestion initially. Traditionally, prescriptions are done in 30 days. Maybe they wouldn't use a 30-day prescription. Maybe it would be a shorter time period. But the purpose of passing this legislation is to give them the ability and the opportunity to have prescriptive authority.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
I'm in a tough position right now, Madam Chair, and those of you who are concerned with this bill. I really support this concept a lot. As you know, I've worked closely with you all to try to find a path forward. And I thought that there were other circumstances, and that's why I thought that the 30-day was reasonable. But I got to say that you're right, for chronic medications, 30 days is the standard. But for acute I write three-day prescriptions all the time for acute medications, the way you described, sir, and I'm a little stuck right now, to be honest with you. I guess what I'm hearing suggests that, although I originally thought 30 was the right number, maybe for now the right answer really is 3, even though it isn't what you would optimally want, but it gets the process started and we watch it for a period of time. And if it turns out that your members are finding that they need something more and have documented evidence of that, then we, and there haven't been any problems, then we come back and regroup. I guess I'm really struggling right now, Madam Chair. I got to tell you.
And Madam Chair, Senator Hayward, maybe 30 isn't the answer, but I also don't think that 3 is the answer, especially in our rural areas. I think that that is way too short of a time period, even preoperatively, for the patient to be prescribed these medications. I mean, there are a lot of things that happen with surgery. It can be postponed. In a lot of these rural areas, offices potentially are closed on Fridays. And so I think that and for a patient going home, postoperatively, 3 days is a very short time period. And so, I mean, I think that we're willing to have discussions if that's what the committee directs us to do about a shorter time period, but 3 days is okay. not the time period that we would in any way be okay with.
Your point is well taken.
And in response,
if I could, question for Senator Steiner Hayward. What is there a magic thing about 3?
No, there's no magic. It's just what I apologize for forgetting your name, sir.
It's okay, Todd.
Todd, what you said was you gave a specific example where it would be perfectly reasonable to write a 3-day prescription. You know, I came into this meeting thinking that maybe we should find a 10-day answer or something like that, which would cover that post-op or pre-op period. It would cover a standard course of antibiotics. It would cover whatever it is that there was that the CRNA was directed to write for and was within the scope of practice for post-op medications. So I think there's got to be some middle ground at this point. I thought the 30 was more for other things, but as I've understood more now, I guess my inclination would be to go to something. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, Senator Hayward, part of our problem with this is the fact that it's been kind of a short time period. So talking to lots of CRNAs to get what they would do with the prescriptive authority is a challenge. I will say that there was a CRNA who emailed us about anticoagulants, which I'm not even going to pretend to know exactly what that means. But
I wouldn't want them prescribing more than 10 days of them.
Okay.
I would not be okay with that. That is way too complicated to manage. I do it, but I only do it in a very controlled, prescribed way, and that's not something that I would ever feel comfortable having a prescribed in an acute way for any extended period of time. Not to be dismissive of your expertise, Todd, or your colleagues, mm-hmm. It's just that those are drugs that require really close monitoring and close interaction with someone who has experience monitoring anticoagulation.
Okay, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it seems to me you could also look at this from the other perspective, that we could, and we're running out of time, so I don't know how much longer we have to negotiate this and still get this through this body. We could pass this at 30, which I think the majority of this body are comfortable with, see if there are any problems, and then come back and revisit. I think it's going to be harder to go up than it is to come down, and that would be my concern. And then we could continue the conversation over on the House side. I'm just afraid that if we have to go back and redraft the amendment, is the fiscal paperwork ready to go on this?
On the dash 5,
only
yes.
On the dash 5s.
On the 30.
So
that would be my preference, mm-hmm. to just move forward with the 30.
Okay, thank you very much. Who would like to speak to the dash 6s?
Do you want to start?
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Mosley, here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Anesthesiologists. We are neutral on the Dash 6 amendments, but are in opposition to the Dash 5 amendments. The potential abuses are limited with a three-day prescription. The Dash 6 amendments does everything that Fawn described, but limits the prescription to 3 days. We feel that there is simply no need for the CRNAs to have prescriptive authority. It is the surgeon's responsibility to write the prescription, since he or she does the follow-up with the patient. CRNAs meet the patient the day of the operation and do no follow-up. Perhaps if a patient needs anti-anxiety medication before surgery or nausea medication after surgery, up to 3 days would be more than enough. This would only be if a surgeon forgets to write a prescription or under a different circumstance. A 30-day prescription without follow-up is poor patient care. If 30 days were the limit, a patient could potentially tell the CRNA that their surgeon did not write a prescription for pain meds when they already did. Then the CRNA gives them another 30 days of pain medication, and we are already facing an opioid crisis in Oregon. We feel that we are making a compromise with the Dash 6 amendments, and even though 3 days is not ideal, this creates necessary limitations.
Do you want me to wait until Mr. Behringer?
Yes, please. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association, and I want to start by thanking everybody up here for trying to meet us in the middle on this bill. We appreciate the efforts for that. The OMA prefers the Dash 6 amendments as well. That will change the 30-day length of prescription to 3. We continue to believe that the CRNA should only prescribe enough medication to last the patient until they can contact their surgeon or their primary care physician. The prescriptive authority should not be greater than the immediate pre- or post-op period because the CRNA is not establishing a relationship with the patient and doesn't need to prescribe more than a few days' worth of that medication, basically enough to get that patient to the specialist or primary care MD, because those are the physicians that are responsible for that patient's care ultimately. And to Senator Shields' point, I think what we're really talking about here is what's going on in Oregon and the bigger picture, and that's the opioid situation. And Oregon, as I think most of you know, is one of 7 states to receive the National Governors Association grant for the Prescription Drug Abuse Project. And one of their tasks is looking at best practices for treatment, and one of those best practices that we're looking at is that 30-day standard. So that's currently something that everybody's taking a look at. So as far as whether that's going to be the standard as we move forward, as we try to get our hands around this, I think that's up for debate as well. So again, we would prefer the Dash 6 amendments. Appreciate everybody's willingness to work on this. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
I need Senator to say something. Hayward. I'm a physician, Ms. Wojcicki, and I'm going to say this bluntly, I'm unbelievably offended by what you just said about our CRNA colleagues. The idea that a CRNA could be snookered by a patient to write an extra 30 days of narcotics in an acute situation. I wouldn't write a prescription for 30 days of narcotics in an acute situation. We only write 30-day prescriptions for people who are on controlled substance contracts. That's the standard of care. And the idea that this would be used in that way to contribute to our opioid crisis, which I agree with, I'm really dismayed that that's the tactic. I'm going to be very blunt. I'm sorry. We have a good relationship in a lot of other ways. We've worked together well on some things. I've tried very hard to work with everybody to find a middle ground, and I appreciate your kind words, Mr. Behringer. I have lots of colleagues in rural Oregon. There are no anesthesiologists in most of rural Oregon. The CRNAs are our colleagues, my family physician colleagues out there, providing the anesthesia, being partners for pain management, for symptom management. Frankly, at this point, I think this bill really isn't ready for prime time on anybody's part, but I don't know.
Okay.
Thank you very much,
Senators Steiner, Hayward, and colleagues. I would like to talk with the members individually, and we'll go with either the 5s or the 6s or maybe a 10-day, that would mean another amendment would have to be submitted. So let's talk. I will talk to each one of you, and then I would like to close the work session on Senate Bill 136 and carry it over to Tuesday.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 460.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 460, we had a public hearing on February 28th. You'll recall this restricts the substitution of biosimilar products
for prescribed biological products. There has an the original bill has an operative date of January 1, 2014. This declares an emergency effective on passage. We have some amendments that are to be discussed, Madam Chair.
Okay. Basically, the dash threes were to just have a two-year sunset because there's just a lot of information we don't have. Well, now the proponents and the opponents said the dash sixes are actually a better compromise. So I would like, the one twos, but the sixes was the compromise. So I would like to have Jonathan Eames and who else was going to come, Fawn?
It must be Fawn Day in committee.
Lucky me.
Do I have to start?
You can start.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames from Eames Consulting. I'm here on behalf of Genentech.
I'm sorry, who? Could you repeat that for the record, please?
My name is Fawn McNeely. I'm here. I think you could actually get in trouble for saying something like that. My name is Jonathan Eames. Oh. I'm here on behalf of Genentech, and we are the ones, along with others, who sponsored and supported this bill. So there are three amendments that we would like to see, and that I think we have general agreement on from both the opponents and the proponents. It does not indicate, and I'm sure Ms. Berry will also discuss their position. This does not indicate, you know, extreme support for the bill or any support for the bill or the concept, but they have agreed to, well, I'll let them say what they've agreed to do and not to do. But the dash ones actually are a clarification that I think have been agreed by the opponents and the proponents that to put into the bill right now. The dash twos remove the physician from we basically matching current law, removing the physician from having to retain the pharmacy record. And the dash sixes are the sunset on the physician notification provision of the bill. And so because I believe that the opponents and proponents are supportive of the bill itself, but that one provision, the physician notification provision, I'm looking at Dr. Steinheimer shaking her head, so she might have some questions about this. That one provision would be what would be sunsetted.
It's the dash sixes.
Okay. Fawn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Fawn Berry representing Mylan, Inc. While, as John said, our company is opposed to the physician notification part of this bill, we are willing to agree to the dash ones, the dash twos, and the dash sixes. We've worked with a number of businesses and organizations in opposition to this bill, and while I can't represent their position today, I will tell you that I have had conversations with them and that we have all agreed to accept the dash ones, dash twos, and dash sixes. This doesn't mean that we support physician notification. You will see us here arguing against it again in 2 years. We would not support an extension of the sunset, but we are willing to allow this bill to move forward. We appreciate the proponents working with us on this issue, and we just want to make sure that our lack of opposition is based on the fact that there wouldn't be additional amendments to the bill.
And I will confirm that's not the case. Dr. Steiner Hayward, I'm going to try to interpret your confusion on why the sunset was written the way it was. Thank you.
Ms. Julie Circa was just trying to explain it to me, and I'm clearly not tracking well today.
Well, here's the deal. When I first got the amendment back, it was actually on another amendment, but it's written the same way. I said the same thing. I said, this is crazy. So the way legislative council, because I couldn't get it, I couldn't figure it out. Well, the way they do it and the way they want to do it is when you're talking about a specific portion of the bill, they adopt an entirely new section without that portion of the bill included and then enact that on a certain date. So now I'm not a lawyer, did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, but the reason they do that is because it's a specific portion of the bill rather than a sunset clause which would sunset the entirety of the bill.
So may I ask a question just to make sure I really understand this? Because I will freely admit to everybody that I'm not at my best today. Does that mean that if a biosimilar were approved between now and January 1st, 2016, that physician notification wouldn't be required?
No. It would be required, but only from when the bill is enacted till the sunset, till January 1st, 2016.
You know what? At this point, if everybody agrees that it's doing what we thought it was supposed to do,
all right.
I'm going to just accept that fact.
All right.
Okay, Senator Cruz?
Senator Steiner Hayward said she's not at her best today. I've never been at my best, so you should feel lucky that at times you are.
Yeah. Okay, with that, we will need to get some paperwork on the dash sixes.
On the ones and the twos and the sixes.
Yeah, we don't have it for the ones and twos.
No,
thought we did.
No.
Oh, okay. We need to get paperwork on the ones, twos, and sixes. Okay. With that, thank you, everyone. Unless there's any other discussion, I will. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 460, and we will carry it over till Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
And I will open a work session on Senate Bill 569.
Madam Chair, 569 had a public hearing on March 18th. This required the Oregon Health Authority to adopt uniform credentialing and privileging standards for providers of telemed services. At that time, there were still some uncomfortabilities.
Which is fairly standard.
The folks went off, came up with a compromise of the consensus amendment, which is the dash 5, and I believe Senator Steiner Hayward is going to walk us through those.
We are going to work some bills, but
This is ready.
Okay. The next two bills will walk you through. If you can be quick, because he has to leave.
Okay. I'll be really quick. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner, Hayward State Senator, District 17, Northwest Portland, unincorporated Washington County, and parts of Beaverton. I would echo everything Ms. Teeley Circa said and really thank everybody who participated in a couple of work groups on this bill. The Dash 5 amendments were created in collaboration with virtually anybody who was interested in this bill, and they addressed the majority of the concerns about this. Initially, in the public hearing, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems testified in opposition, but with the Dash 5 amendments, they now support this bill. Not just neutral, but support, and I have permission to say that. I'd also like to state on the record that the requirements would only apply to hospitals in this state. Other hospitals could use them should they so choose, but they only are required to use them if they're located in this state. If you would like more information, I'm happy to provide it, but I don't think it's necessary. Everybody's happy at this point.
Great. We are in work session.
Well, Madam Chair, I just, as chief co-sponsor of the bill, and
the only one.
Well, and virtually everybody else in the building as a sponsor of the bill, I find it interesting that you would do a total gut and stuff on a bill after you had everybody's signatures. That was a joke.
Okay. Well, session.
This is good work. So I'm going, Madam Chair, I will move the Dash 5 amendment to 569.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 569. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 569 as amended by the Dash 5 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 569 as amended with the Dash 5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner-Hurd.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
Excuse.
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Montezuma.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Steiner Hayward will carry the bill.
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 569 and open a work session on Senate Bill 722. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 722 had a public hearing last week. We didn't have the paperwork on it. We do now. You'll recall this was directs the health authority to conduct a study assessing the activities relating to human papillomavirus. The amendment directed the health authority to prepare a human papillomavirus and the comprehensive related cancer control plan into and in addition to the Oregon Comprehensive Cancer Plan. There's a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact with the Dash 1 amendments, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 722.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 722. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 722 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 722
as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Sandra Herron.
Aye.
Senator Knope.
Excused.
Senator Shields.
Excused.
Vice Chair
Cruz. I'm still here. Also, I'll vote yes.
Motion carries. And I know that Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Girard were testifying on this. So,
either one of us is fine. Why don't
Senator Girard, and I know you can talk.
I can always
on the
talk
floor
about it if we need to, but I'm happy to
we'll
have
we'll carry
you
the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 722. And are we ready to adjourn? I think we've moved everything over that we're supposed to move over, and we are adjourned.